Wonderful reminder that it is amazing grace that Christ died for us on the cross in our place. Kind of astounding. You know, I'll be talking today about I am the way, the truth, and the life. I'm going to be focusing on I am the truth. And it's astounding that within a certain segment of the church today, that what you just sang is no longer celebrated. That the fact that Christ took our place, the substitutionary atonement of Jesus Christ in churches that are pretty big, no longer celebrate, no longer teach that great truth. And so thank you for that reminder. Before we get into the text, I want to just go back over. Oh, and I want to say this too. So I am going to be talking about I am the way, the truth, and the life today. And I'm going to be focusing on truth, as I said earlier. There is no way, there's just no way of talking about the idea of truth biblically without it being somewhat philosophical. And so because of that, I may have to get into some things people may not be as familiar with. And if that is true, and you have a question about something that I say, simply write it into the comment section on Facebook. I don't know if YouTube has a comment section or not. They don't. But write it into the comment section, and then Mike or Bree back there will raise their hand, and they will ask that question of me, and I will stop what I'm doing, and I will answer that question for you. So we can make it interactive in that way, so that you track where I'm going. Now, Austin, if you could go back to the call to worship, I included the call to worship intentionally because of what the Apostle Paul has to say and how I think it helps to frame the conversation that I'm going to have later on today. And I also need to say that probably this is part one of I Am the Way, the Truth. It's probably part one of the truth segment of this particular passage. I may have to come back next Sunday and finish that because it is that involved. So, and even when I say it's that involved, I'm not even going to be scratching the surface of the significance of that statement that Jesus made about himself. But if you would go back to Ephesians 4, verses 17 through 24, here is the Apostle Paul addressing the Christians in the city of Galatia. Now, Galatia had a problem, and part of the problem was that there was what we would call a lot of synergy taking place. That is to say that certain Christians who were Christians at the time would go about and they would take other beliefs from other faiths and they would incorporate it into the Christian faith. And the Apostle Paul is saying to the Christians in Galatia, look, what you learned about Jesus is sufficient. You cannot improve upon what it is that you've already learned and what I'm about to tell you. And so what I want you to do, he's saying, is I want you to lay aside those other worldly influences that you've allowed to make their way into the Christian faith. I want you to be discerning. So he says that and a lot more, but that's the overarching context and purpose for which the Apostle Paul wrote the letter to the Christians in Galatia. And so he says in chapter 4, as he begins to sum up his conclusion, he says, verse 17, so I tell you this and insist on it in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do, as unbelievers do. In other words, he's saying even people who are of other religious faiths, they are unbelievers. And when he implies the word live, he's not talking just about physically living. He's talking about living in the same manner, with the same customs, with the same values, with the same behaviors, the same beliefs. I don't want you living like them, he's saying, in the futility of their thinking. If they are unbelievers and they are embracing anything that is other than Christ, it's futile. I guess just stop here for a minute and say, look, I think this live streaming thing is really cool. I think the YouTube thing is great. I think that it's wonderful how we've been able to maintain our sense of community through those kinds of things. And here we have the Apostle Paul talking about what is true and what is untrue, that to follow Christ is true. To follow anything other than Christ is untrue. It's futile. So you heard it here first. I'm just telling you, in the not too distant future, there are going to be a group of people who will hear something that I just said. That if you follow anything or anyone other than Jesus Christ, you are futile in your thinking. Those people will begin to petition Facebook and YouTube and say, did you hear what that pastor or what those pastors are saying? That anyone who doesn't believe like in Jesus the way, anybody who doesn't believe in Jesus is futile in their thinking. And they're going to say, that's hate speech. And they are violating your community standards. It's going to happen. And so if you know any churches who've determined that this is going to be the way that they do things in the future, that they're going to depend utterly and completely on something like Facebook live streaming or YouTube, and that happens in the not too distant future, what do you think is going to happen to them? That's why community is so important. That's why physical community is so important. That's why we live life and faith together as much as possible. And that's why when we get back together, we're going to celebrate. And we're going to come back together as a church family. And we're going to bond again. And we're going to love each other. And we're going to enjoy being as one and as a community in the physical presence of it in this room. We'll probably still keep live streaming going, but we're not going to become dependent upon it. It's going to be something that we add to. It will not replace what we're doing. So just so you know, because when we address these kinds of doctrines, these kinds of ways of believing, when it comes to truth, there are a few things that are more antagonistic to the world than when we say we believe in the supersessionism of Jesus Christ, that Jesus is the only way, because he said he is the only way. Verse 18, they are darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is due to the hardening of their hearts. Paul could have written this today. He could have absolutely written this today. It would have been just as applicable today as it was back then. So I'm just wondering if any of the Christians who read this letter aloud somewhere in the city of Galatia, and there were some other people who were following other faiths, other philosophies, I wonder how offended they would be, because truth offends. There's no getting away from that. Look, that's just been one of the great pushdowns in the church today. Many have mitigated the importance of truth so much in order to not offend. I'm not saying that we purposely offend people. I'm saying that you cannot diminish Christ in such a way so much that it doesn't offend people, because Christ is offensive. Who he is, what he calls us to, runs contrary to what the world says it is, and what the world says we ought to be. Those two things clash, and there's no getting away from that. It's a reality, and it's a reality that we have to learn how to live better with than what we do. Verse 18 again, they are darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. So there are many people in the world in which we live today that when we want to convey the truth of Jesus Christ, they cannot hear it because the hearts are hardened. Verse 19, having lost all sensitivity, the capacity to understand it. They have given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity, and they are full of greed. So because they cannot understand the life of God, because they reject what God calls them to, they instead choose a life of sensuality. Please tell me how that is any different than how we live today. It's not different. It's exactly the same. It was less the same, I think, when we lived under what you would call a Judeo-Christian worldview, but now that we live more under what almost any historian would say is a progressive world and life view that runs counter to the Christian, to the Judeo-Christian world and life view. And I don't know that I'll get to that this Sunday, but I certainly will address it next Sunday. So here we are then. I want to set this because my job then as a pastor is really to pick up what the Apostle Paul was saying here and say, look, so I tell you this, and insist on it in the Lord. This is the Apostle Paul telling fellow believers, look, you've got to correct your way of thinking. You have to become more astute. You have to be sharper in terms of what is going on in your world and in your church. You have to be more discerning. And so I'm saying that to us. There is no battle. There is no battle that is more voracious, more important, more aggressive than the battle of who and what conveys truth in our world today. There is none. So when Jesus declares himself to be the truth, particularly that portion runs smack in the face of what our culture is saying. And it is offensive to them. And there, in many ways, there's no way to mitigate that. There's no way for us to back away from that. That is simply a hill that we have to stand on. And unapologetically, lovingly, but unapologetically. So, again, for those of you who just might be tuning in, we are on a series called the Seven Great I Am Statements of Jesus in the Gospel of John. And we've already gone through the I am the bread of life, I am the light of the world, I am the gate, I am the good shepherd, I am the resurrection and the life, and I am the way, the truth, and the life from John 14:6, which is what we are on now. And as I've said before, and I will reiterate again, I think this is one of the pivotal statements, not only in the Gospel of John, but I would say in the entire New Testament. Jesus lays it down. He sums up the essence of who he is. And it's this sentiment that got him crucified by the Jews, and it was this sentiment that got him crucified by the Romans. So let's turn to the bigger context, the larger context from John 14:1-7, read through that again, where Jesus said to his disciples, because he's talking about his life coming to an end, he's going to offer up his life, he's going to be sacrificed, and all of the reality of that is beginning to settle itself down on the disciples, particularly Thomas, and so they are troubled, and so these are words of comfort offered to the disciples after he's done the triumphal entry, he's in Jerusalem, and before too long, he will be arrested and crucified. So he says, do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you may also be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going. And then Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you are going. So how can we know the way? Jesus answered, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Do you see what he's saying here? In each of those adjectives there, I am the is predicated by a definite article. And so that definite article is the, meaning the only, the, without exception, exclusively. I am exclusively the way. I am exclusively the truth. I am exclusively the life. And no one, he's saying, no one comes to the Father. No one comes to God. No one gets into heaven. No one has eternal life except through me. We can't run from this. We can't avoid it. It is that significant. It's that important not only for the world, but for us. This is the very foundation upon which we evangelize, that we do missions. It's the very foundation upon how we live our life, the values that we have, how we do business, how we're good neighbors. It's the very essence of that. So then moving on, I want to begin to unpack this idea of what it means to be, what it means for Jesus to be the truth. So just to pick up, and Austin, I'm going through, I had several slides here where it says, there's no more of a contentious cultural battle today than what it means for Jesus to be the truth and for Christians to imitate and follow that truth. So this is kind of the premise of the message. There is no more of a contentious cultural battle today than what it means for Jesus to be the truth and for Christians to imitate and follow that truth. So there are two pieces to that that I'll get to and I'll unpack, but let me just jump to the second piece momentarily. If Jesus is the truth and we are to be like Jesus, then that means that we have to embody the same kind of truth that he taught and that he is in our life. And that truth runs counter to how the world, how some of your friends, how your bosses, how some of your teachers, any significant person in your life that you can think of, it runs counter to what they believe and what they think, and that they would find it to be offensive that you would embrace it in the way that you do. So what is truth? Well, truth is what is the actual reality of existence in life and how it's derived from and how we are to act upon it. Truth is the actual reality of existence in life and how it is derived from and acted upon. So, any of you who have studied philosophy, there was a guy about 400 years before the birth of Christ. His name was Plato, not Plato. Plato, P-L-A-T-O, probably the greatest Greek philosopher, followed by Aristotle and Socrates. They all lived pretty close. They were actually disciples of Plato. But in any case, Plato talked about what was called the world of the forms. And basically what he meant by that was that for anything that you see here on earth, it's in its imperfect state. But there's a perfect counterpart to that in heaven, in this world. And so there's this world upon which it is the true reality. And from that reality, everything else is based. But in this world, in the material world, it's an imperfect replication of what really is perfect up here. So when we talk about truth, then, there is this reality that belongs to God, that originates, that is God, and everything else that is reality has originated from God. And it is perfect. And everything else is based on that reality. And when this part of when this part of our reality doesn't conform to that reality that belongs to God, when it is imperfect and it does not conform, then it is out of step. And it will be judged. If it cannot be made to conform, then it will be judged at some point in the future. So truth is what the actual reality is. God is the actual reality. Any values, any beliefs, any appropriate behaviors are all based on God's reality. Anything outside of that is wrong and runs counter to who he is and what he requires of us. So without truth, then, we are not only blind, but we are in bondage. So how many people have you known over the years that could not come to terms about a certain truth in their life? Like they were an alcoholic, okay? And no matter how many interventions you did, no matter how many conversations you had, you couldn't convince them. They were blind to that. Or how about somebody who held a grudge? And you say, look, you're holding a grudge. You need to. I'm not holding a grudge. I'm fine. But they would never come to terms with it. And because they would never come to terms with it, those relationships could never be fixed. And so they would suffer and the other person would suffer. So when we don't comport to what is really true, we are blind and we are in bondage. Without truth, we are blind and we are in bondage. If we cannot comport our lives to what is true, and we are blind to that, and that's what the Apostle Paul earlier said in Galatians, where he said, look, because their hearts have become darkened. They've become stubborn, so they can't see what is really true. And so for everybody who's in this room and anybody who would be listening, regardless of what state we are in our life, whether we are a non-Christian or whether we're a really mature Christian, on some level, significant or otherwise, there are certain truths in our lives that we refuse to come to terms with, and we are blinded to it, and as a result, we are in bondage because that truth cannot set us free. Because truth actually sets us free. When we come to terms with certain truths about ourselves, it's freeing. So, you know, it's like maybe we have this close relationship with a friend, and maybe there's a particular sin that we struggle with in our life, and we think we're the only one to struggle with that sin. And then we talk to another friend, and they say, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. Thank you for being truthful with me. And when they say that, and when we have that conversation, it's freeing to have that conversation. Because now we can accept that reality in our life. If we don't accept what is true in our life, then what the untruth is will always have control over us. So it's like being sick. You go to a doctor and you say, I think I have this kind of an illness. Why do you say that? Because I have these symptoms. But the symptoms that you tell him that you have are only 3 of the 6 symptoms. You don't really know, you're not aware of those other 3 yet, or you're not telling them about it. So then they give you medication based on 3 symptoms and not 6 symptoms. So what happens? Do you get better? No, you don't get better, usually. You get sick or you get sicker. Because the true reality of your situation hasn't been revealed in such a way that the solution can become yours. So in whatever way we do not embrace truth in our life, that reality there that is harming us stays in place. And it has control over us. So it's really important for all Christians, as the Apostle Paul was saying, and I must insist upon, he's saying, that we as believers come to terms with not only how important truth is in our life, but how contentious this battle has become. And so we live in this culture that has done everything that it can to suppress the truth of who God is, to diminish the truth of who God is, and even to destroy the truth of who. And so comprehensively in every institution that is a part of our culture, there is this active work to suppress, to diminish, and to destroy the truth of who God is. I mean, surely you see the empirical evidence of this. I mean, do I really need to go through list after list of things that are evident of that? So here we are as believers living in this world where the very thing that we rally our life and base our life and imitate our life around is being undermined. And so, which is one of the reasons why David in Psalm 11 says, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? This is the world that we live in. The foundations are being destroyed. And so what can the righteous do? Well, if you read the fuller context of that particular passage, the two preceding verses talk about how the wicked, he says, I can't run from the wicked like a bird who flies through the air. They're seeking to do me harm. He says, but the foundations are being destroyed. What can the righteous do? And then in the next verse, he talks about verse 4, he says, I'm going to seek refuge in God. I'm going to renew my orientation. I'm going to become stable in the refuge, and I'm going to immerse myself in the person of God and so restore the foundation. But we live in this world where the foundations are being destroyed. Make no mistake. There isn't a Christian here who is listening or watching this. There isn't, I'm telling you, that does not, because of the manner in which the way the foundations are being destroyed, that everyone here, that your life ought to have a prophetic voice. Thus saith the Lord. Either in terms of what you say or how you live your life. Years ago, when I was looking to get into to do my master's work, I had to take this psychological test. It was a Minnesota something, MPPA or something like that. So I took the test. And it really, the test is designed to evaluate how a person sees themselves and how they conduct themselves in life. And so when I got my results back, part of the analysis said, based on how other people live their lives and based on the answers that you have given, you are faking goodness. Like, what's that supposed to mean? I talked to a PhD friend of mine. I said, oh, that's what it means. It says that how you live your life and the values that you have are way outside the standards of how people live their lives and how they, the values that they have. And so they said, you're just, you know, you're living in denial and you're faking goodness about your life. It's a true story. So if you take how that test came up with its standards, then apparently, and look, I was no angel. I was a decent guy, but I mean, there were certainly many more people that I knew who lived a better life than me. I don't know how they would have scored on that test. They said that about me, but the bar about what goodness is and the importance of goodness and the truth of that goodness has been substantially dropped. And the world doesn't know what to do with us. They, in fact, in many respects, you could live a good life, a life in Christ, say nothing to certain people, and they would still would hate you for it because the witness of your life has a prophetic element to it. and they feel like the way that you, because how you live your life and you don't do what they do, even though you said nothing to them about it, it irritates them. It makes them angry because it brings conviction to their heart. So look, when we talk about the foundations being destroyed, we have to understand that Western civilization has moved from a matrix of the truth to a matrix of a truth. You can go to the next slide, Austin, that would be helpful. Western civilization has moved from a matrix of the truth, definite article, the truth. These are universal truths. These truths are absolutes. These truths are have always been. When we moved from this idea of absolute truth, the truth, to a truth, and that what, so there are a myriad of a truths, right? So there are all kinds of different religions. There are all kinds of different philosophies. But not only that, there are almost 8 billion people on the planet. And each of those 8 billion people should determine for themselves what their truth is for them. Now, 200 years ago, that would have been an absurd statement anywhere in Western civilization. Nobody would have said that. But that is what is being taught. That is what is being lived in our world today. And it runs directly in conflict with who God is and how God says we ought to be and thus how we ought to live our lives. Truth today is regarded and practiced as being incredibly subjective. It's regarded as being, so what I mean by subjective is that truth is determined by the individual inwardly. What is true for them ought to be held in high regard, just as true as any other truth that anybody else says, except for the kind of truth that I am talking about. That kind of truth in this world is inappropriate. Subjective truth is highly appropriate in the world in which we live today. Truth is arbitrary. So it's not only subjective, but it's arbitrary. So what do I mean by that? So in much of higher education today, as well as social science, if a person wakes up in the morning and says, you know, I think really, even though I'm a man, I'm going to be a female today, because I think that's how I've been made. So I'm going to be a female today. But if I wake up in the next morning, right, and I want to switch back to being a man and only exclusively for that day to be a man, then I'm going to be a man that day. There are probably 1,000 derivations off of that. So if somebody wants to wake up in the morning and say, you know, I know people think I'm human, but I'm really a cat. So I'm going to conduct myself in such a way that I'm a cat. Now you think, oh, that's a stupid example. I am telling you. There are those people out there, and there are those social science people, therapists, who affirm that. Used to be that any kind of fatophilia or a pedophilia was universally considered to be egregious and wrong. But today, if a person says, I think I was born to always be attracted to young children or to always be attracted to young teenagers. I was born that way. And so that's who I am today in higher education. And in some of the political world, that is being affirmed. That those people should not be prosecuted. That we should not have to defend ourselves and our children against them. So truth is subjective, and truth is arbitrary in the world in which we live. So we believe, though, that Jesus Christ is the clearest manifestation of truth. We believe that what Jesus taught and who Jesus is the absolute best expression of what truth is and ought to be. So in terms of what really is, we believe that Jesus is that truth. In terms of how we ought to act or our values, we believe that Jesus is the person who conveys that to us. We believe as a result of that, and this has been true for almost 2,000 years historically, that truth is universal. That is to say that who Jesus is and what he taught applies to everything. We have been taught for 2,000 years that Jesus and the truth that he embodies is the absolute. It is the standard by which all other things must be understood and by which all other things must comport themselves too. We believe that Jesus as truth is eternal, that it never changes. It is not arbitrary. It is not subjective. It always is. So I just want to take a few more minutes and conclude this thought, and then I will get to the text more next week. But I do want to say this, just by way of example, so we understand how truth works. There's this statement, and we've all heard this before. You oftentimes hear it in like sports, in competition. But this statement that says, the truth hurts, right? So like, you know, if somebody doesn't perform well and you look at their stats and you say, look, the truth hurts, those are what your stats are. Or if you're in sales and you didn't reach a certain benchmark and so you're you don't get as good of a review from your employees, look, the truth hurts, that's what your stats say. I don't know what all these other circumstances are, but that's what the stats say. One of the great examples of truth in our life is the example of a mirror, right? Which, by the way, so as I speak into this camera here, a camera always puts about 10 or 15 pounds on, so I'm not really this heavy in real life. I mean, that's, you know, so the camera's lying to you about how big I really am. Okay, so I just wanted to make that clear so you know. But a mirror is different, unless you go into a circus mirror or something like that, carnival mirror. But I just want to say these three things about when we look into a mirror. The mirror, when we look into it, often reveals hurtful truths. Right? So when I was putting on clothes this morning, I thought, that's hurtful. I'm not wearing that this morning. So because, you know, I've gained some weight because I can't work out as much and stuff like that. And it frustrates me, you know, But the mirror is truthful. It is what it is. I did gain weight. It's clear. That's what happened to me. So the truth is like a mirror. Sometimes when somebody says the truth or we discover a truth about ourselves, it's hurtful. It might even be offensive. But it is what it is. It's true. And just because we're hurt by it or offended by it doesn't make it any less true. No matter how much I'm frustrated about when I look at the mirror that I've gained some weight, it's not going to make the weight go away. It's not going to make that reality that I gained weight any less true. The mirror says what the mirror says. But on the other hand, the mirror can also reflect truth. So anybody who goes clothes shopping, you know what I'm saying. You take a group of clothes into the changing room, you put on some, you say, there's no way I can wear that. You put on others, you think, that's really flattering. That looks good on me. I'm glad I got that. It's affirming. The mirror affirms what it's showing, what it demonstrates. And so truth can be an affirming thing in our life as well. It's not just hurtful or offensive, but it can be an affirming thing. Sometimes, though, the truth also can reinforce denial of truth. So no matter how much I look in the mirror and say I weigh 20 pounds less and live in denial of that and conduct my life based on that denial, the truth is I still gained whatever, 20 pounds. It's there. It's telling me. And that's what God does. God never sort of backs away from the truth. He keeps telling us. He keeps instructing us. He keeps saying, this is the truth about your life, about your reality, about these things. And we can live in denial because we still want to do these things that we shouldn't do. We can be hurt, we can be frustrated, but it still doesn't take away the truth of what he's saying. And that denial puts us back into bondage. But understand this. If Jesus is truth, and we are to be like Jesus, then in whatever way Jesus is truth, we must become that truth. And this is kind of like the central idea of what I'm talking about. I mean, if you take anything away, in terms of what I've said, take this away. If Jesus is truth and you believe him to be truth, and we are to be like Jesus, then in whatever way Jesus is truth, we must become that truth. And if you become that truth that is Jesus, you put yourself in the crosshairs of the world in which we live today. There's no backing away from that. Remember John 6:56, where Jesus said in the I am the bread of life discourse, he says, whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me and I in him. So in other words, he's saying he lives in us if we feed on him. And if he lives in us and we feed on him, what he is, we become. And what we become puts us in the crosshairs of the world in which we live today. So next week then, I'm going to talk about what some of those elements are in terms of the truth of what Jesus is and the truth of what we must become. And then we'll get into a little more specifically, and I think a little more philosophically, of what truth looks like in the world in which we live. I just want to say to you, look, for some of us here, this might be a bit more than what we signed on for. It might be a bit more academic or whatever, but there is no way that we can talk about Jesus as truth without being somewhat philosophical and complex. And so I hope that you come prepared next Sunday. And if you have questions, please feel free. We can ask the questions anonymously and ask me, and I will stop what I'm doing. It is so important that we all walk away with a better grasp and understanding, a better command of what it means for Jesus to be truth to us and to the world. It is that important.